I'm glad we made this happen.
Cool. Got ready to jump on and everything. This is a special edition. I had one earlier today of the online dinner party with Mark Lee. As Zach doesn't know, I've actually got three programs that I'm doing here on IBM.TV, which is a brainchild of Nick Valvado and a young lady named Kim Calhoun. And they've created this kind of like podcasting network that incorporates regular standard podcasting and audio podcasting along with the video component. So they've got this network with all kinds of great programming and things of that nature. So we started with the radio show with Mark Lee, and then we went to two other shows that they've given me now as well, Mullins Music and Memories, which air, both of those first two air on Mondays. And then on Wednesdays, we usually have the online dinner party with Mark Lee, and then we've got special edition. So, like I said, I had a special edition earlier today with Sandy Darity, who I know Zach knows is being a proponent of reparations and things of that nature. But now we've got Zach on. I've known Zach for a while. He's been involved in politics and been involved in community activism and things of that nature. We've seen each other over the HI Heritage Center, which unfortunately, like so many of the cultural arts centers around the country, have been shut down by the virus, and we're doing virtual events with my program director Q, and of course Angela is running great programming and things of that nature to keep us afloat. But at the same time, it's not the same of having our full staff and things of that nature. And I know a number of people are struggling. Actually, even which was a surprise. In fact, I shouldn't have been surprised, but the amount of folks that have been closed down in our Black business community, both here in the state and nationally, is just devastating, according to what Sandy was saying on our show about reparations. So, this whole thing is definitely going to create, in my mind, a depression, and could even be creating a worse than a depression in our African-American and minority community. So, Zach, one, glad that you could join me. Glad to see a good friend here having this conversation. So what are some of the things that folks may not know about you? And also, if you would, talk a little bit about what are some of the things that you've learned now that you've had this representative office. And by the way, I was just amazed that you stepped into some amazing shoes. We know that we lost a great legend in the sense of losing John Lewis recently. But, you know, you stepped into the foot of Floyd McKissick Jr. And, of course, his father was Floyd McKissick Sr. So definitely you are stepping into some powerful shoes as well. So just talk a little bit to the folks that are watching. We got listeners from around the world. I know one of my producers, Ankit, is out of India. We got people out of South Africa and throughout. So, but of course, we do like to have our folks from Durham and North Carolina. So just share with folks a little bit about yourself.
Let me first welcome them to Durham, which is really, really important to me. I rep that place no matter where I go. If you can make it in Durham, you can make it anywhere. And a fun fact before I start is that you talked about John Lewis, who had a historic career, may he rest in peace. A personal friend of mine is his successor. And so we're about the same age. We got involved in Young Democrats, and our political histories have mirrored each other. And so I'm so proud of her and to know the person that's going to carry on his legacy, similar to, you know, what I was faced with when carrying on the legacy for Representative Mashaw. And, you know, really proud of that legacy, because that's a strong Durham and North Carolina legacy. A few things, you know, things that people may not know. A lot of people don't realize I've lived here for 20 years, you know, and I got active that first year. And so some people, when they look back, they're like, oh, my God, we met in 2001, or, you know, we met. And, you know, and sometimes it's like, well, Zach, I don't even know where I met you, but I know I've known you all this time in different spaces. You know, quick things is, you know, father of three boys, two little ones. They have autism. My wife, Tracy, and I, you know, live in Durham and East Durham. I am a proud graduate of North Carolina Central University, go Eagles, Elizabeth City State University as well. I work in development, fundraising, alumni engagement, which is, you know, part of my passion. I am, you know, someone who has, you know, worked almost on every level, you know, presidential, locally, you know, I was a field director for David Price for a long time. I worked in the corporate and nonprofit space. And, you know, and I originally grew up in Eastern North Carolina, in a really small town of about 800 people. I graduated with about 39 of them, and, you know, moved here and had the opportunity to get engaged. And it was a paradise. You know, you had Black elected leaders with a history of knowing who they were, are, and what their rights were and how they could shape the world. And, you know, that's all I needed. And, you know, since I've had the opportunity of having both, you know, sort of state and national and local experience, going into the legislature, it, for me, it was a little different because I was, you know, when I started working for David Price, I had, you know, also helped to co-found the Minority Caucus for the Young Democrats in North Carolina so we could bring more people into the fold. I was on the convention floor when that young senator from Illinois gave his speech, and you knew that night he was going to be president of the United States. And but you know, at the same time, we were working to make sure that we could keep Democrats, in my opinion, you know, my side of the aisle, elected and good, just people who believed in good government. And so I had a chance to meet a lot of people back in those early days, you know, 15, 20 years ago, that have now all come back, and now they're working for their governors, they're working for presidentials, they're working and running for office and being elected themselves. And so while we were working to do and get all those people elected and get those good policy things passed, like the ACA, which I had the opportunity to work on, I worked, you know, worked for the Obama outfit here for a couple months during the passage of the ACA. And so when I got to the General Assembly, you know, we had worked up to 2010 trying to get all this stuff going. And then in 2010, Republicans took over the General Assembly. And so then when I came back and was a state officer and started, you know, making sure that we kept getting, you know, kept organizing and kept making sure that we were working really hard to get back in power, it meant a lot to be in the seat where you could help finally continue to shape that policy. And so it's really personal to me because in Durham, we have shades of liberalism, you know, right. Yes. But when you're in the General Assembly, it is a very, that person on the other side of the aisle, even though I may like them, they have a very different view of the world. And it is opposed to, in many ways, you know, public health and safety, like we see now with, you know, the COVID-19 pandemic. They don't seem sensitive to the way that police and communities of color engage and interact. They don't seem to understand the health impacts on communities of color. And, you know, and it's about more, it's about politics more than it is about people. And so I'm here to, you know, to finish the job that we started a long time ago. We got Governor Cooper back. We broke the supermajority. And now it's time for us to take the majority and do the things that, you know, that just makes sense for people. And I'm from Durham, live, you know, go there to represent my people. But what Durham wants is what's best for North Carolina. Does that make sense? Because if North
Carolina, you mentioned your rural background and everything, and that you grew up in a small town. I actually also went to school in a small town. I was born here in Durham, born at Lincoln Hospital, but I was raised in a little town called Wharton when my folks had that in the late 70s. So I definitely know about small town living. Graduated from John Graham High School, which was actually the next to the last graduating class there, because then we were supposed to, I think, be the last graduating class, but it went, as you know, sometimes things happen in education, 1 year passed. So they merged it and it became what is now Warrington High School. So, and it's been Warrington High School ever since like around 81, 82, but we were supposed to have been the one of the last classes, but didn't quite happen that way.
You know, and so I think it's, you know, and I didn't know you from Warrington. That's like, that means you know the McKissicks and all that stuff from way back when. And what, you know, what really is at stake, you know, for me is making sure that, you know, North Carolina, you know, if we do right by all the things that I mentioned, that immediately helps people of color. And that's, and when you're looking at something, you know, like we're looking at Black Lives Matter now. So people will say to you, well, all lives matter. Well, that's true. We all know that. But right now, Black lives are, you know, in danger and need a direct focus. Does that make sense? And so as we start to, you know, to think about how we can do better by our marginalized communities, everybody's going to benefit, you know? And so paying $15, if you pay people $15, guess what they're going to do, Mark?
They're going to do better. They're going to spend some of that money in our economy, which we know we need to have more of our money spent in our economy. And two, they're going to do better with themselves. They'll be able to pay their rent at a regular rate if they're getting kind of good wages. They'll be able to have food on the table, things of that nature. So definitely that's what a lot of things are needed. I was actually surprised at some of the reactions folks have had against, you mentioned Governor Cooper, against some of the things Governor Cooper is even doing with what's going on with the pandemic. I think that he's done a great job and things of that nature. I had no problem with us staying in phase two, which I know we're in now for another 5 weeks. But I do know that there are folks that have been complaining about that. They've been complaining that it's going too slow, or that it's not being opened fast enough. I guess that's the best way to put it, that it's not being opened fast enough. And to me, that makes no sense. But I was just wondering, for those that are watching that might be on that side of the aisle, what is your argument that we're going at the right pace, or that, if anything, we need to be more cautious?
No. And the thing about it is my heart goes out to anyone who owns a business, you know, bar, gym, you know, a restaurant that's struggling, something that, you know, you woke up one day and all of a sudden this pandemic hit and no one knew how to interact or engage it. And they ended up, you know, being a part of an economy, much like the hotel industry, where, you know what, you bring a lot of people together, and that's your business model. But when you're talking about a public health pandemic, we can't afford, from a health perspective, to allow those things to be open, because we want to stop the spread. And we've been doing a decent job in North Carolina. If you look at North Carolina compared to other southern states, and especially a lot of those states who went ahead and tried to reopen, they had to end up retracting, right? And that's not where you want to be. And so Governor Cooper, you talk about trial by fire. I mean, he really has been a steady, incredible hand. And he's thinking about these people. And I understand, everybody understands it. But if, a student that is not alive cannot go to school, a person who doesn't have their health cannot go to work, right? And so though it hurts, we're going to have to stay in phase two a little bit longer. But what I will say to those people is, while states are having to make this tough decision, where we need to be focusing is in Washington, D.C. We do not have, Mark, we do not have a plan for it. We don't have a national testing plan. We don't have a relief package that the Senate and the White House will sign off on to help these small businesses, to make sure that, you know, federal coffers are being hurt big time. And so the federal government should step in to make sure that states can give these companies a lifeline. We're trying to do what's best for everybody. But the federal government has, I think, you know, failed us in not preparing on the upfront in the beginning to understand it and to put together a comprehensive plan, and then not providing, you know, enough resources. You can't starve. This isn't a cold. Is it starve a cold? You know, all that sort of stuff. You don't do that. You just don't do that. People's livelihoods are on the line, just like these business owners. And I think I heard one yesterday say that, you know, if we have to make these decisions, the government should be in a place to help us stay afloat. And the only entity that has the pocketbooks big enough to do that is the federal government.
Yeah, that's very true. And unfortunately, I wish more people would have that kind of understanding. Now, the other thing that I found interesting on the national level is there seems to be a rise in the quote unquote, even in the Democratic Party, the anti-establishment candidates. And some people would put AOC in that category. Some people would put Rashida Tlaib in that category. Yeah, and there were some recent folks that were recently elected that might be put in that category, including one that I think was in the Midwest, if I remember correctly, was recently be elected. So I was just wondering, what are your thoughts about that? You did come up through the ranks and everything. So I was just wondering, how are you feeling about that as one who kind of came up through the ranks? But there seems to be a push for folks to be engaged in the democratic process, but to kind of bring a fresher voice or a newer voice.
Yeah, you know, and the thing about it is that the thing that about coming up through the ranks is that means that I had to learn every rung of the ladder. Does that make sense? And yeah. I've had to deal with every side of it. Even when you're talking about like this new, and Durham has seen a shift in the last 5 years. I know you've seen this locally, a shift in its politics and the way people organize and even the spectrum. You talk about, you know, center or left and far left. And so we've had those iterations. And I think that coming up for me has allowed me to engage and navigate all of them. And when you talk about the anti-establishment, the thing that you can't do is you cannot ever stop campaigning. And you can never stop serving and doing the small things that make a difference. So what, you know, Mr. Clay, Representative Clay, what happened to him, he had the seat for 20 years. His dad had it for 32 years. Wow. Right. And sometimes what that does is it puts you in a situation where everybody knows me. And what happens again, and as I talk about sort of my trajectory, if I had to navigate all that, he was, you know, sort of sitting up here a little bit and didn't have to stay as close to the ground or didn't stay as close to the ground as things were shifting. And so when he put his feet back down, the ground has shifted away from him. Does that make sense? Yeah, and so there were new characters in the play who you didn't pay attention to. And the next thing you know, they came around the corner with guns. You know, you didn't, you know, make sure that you continuously, you know, sometimes you have to take serious these new little organizations and new operations, because those are voters that care about something. And eventually they're going to get political power if they organize long enough. And then I think one thing that didn't do him any favors is, you know, the not being as engaged in the Ferguson stuff since Michael Brown. When something like that is happening, you know, you have to be, you know, even if you're not there on the ground physically, you got to be reaching out and making sure that these people know that you care about those things and that you're doing something. You're, even if they don't see you, they know, like, okay, I'm looking on TV and he's proposing legislation. And one thing I'm sensitive to, and I think when we start talking about my side, anybody's side of the aisle, when you talk about local government, when you talk about state and you talk about federal government, her name is, what's her name? She just won. I can't remember her name now, but she won the seat recently from Representative Clay. People are going to look at, do you reach out to me? Do you serve me? When I call your office, do I get good constituent services? But most importantly, have things changed, right? Yeah. And when someone can say, I've been poor for 20 years, nothing has changed. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes a lot.
When you talk about city and county government, and when you start talking about congressional, that's a little different. But when you, especially when you talk about city, county, and somewhat state, right? Because we, you know, dynamics play a role. You got to show that at least you're fighting, even if you're the only one talking. Does that make sense? People will take that versus you feeling comfortable and feeling like you don't have to do those things. You can start playing inside baseball, you know?
Yeah.
And when you start playing too much inside baseball, you forget that there's a whole game going on around you. And I think that's what happened to them. People that are getting swept, so to speak, you know, like the AOCs and, you know, Tlaibs and then winning those seats over longtime incumbents. People want, they're almost tired of, like Baldwin and Ed Malcolm and Martin said, people are tired of someone else's timeline. I am in pain and have been in pain for a long time. And I'm tired of being poor. I'm tired of police beating us to death. I'm tired, you know, and I need somebody that's going to do it. And when you have, like Mickey, for example, people never question where Mickey was on that stuff. So Mickey never had to worry about people coming for him. Does that make sense? Yeah. Even if you were five, if you were eight, you knew Mickey Michaud was talking that if nobody else said it. And right. So that's the difference when you talk about him and a John Lewis, right, versus somebody like Clay that, you know, I don't even know where he stands on these things. And you can't, you as an elected official, as a candidate, you always have to be in that mode of meeting new people and bringing new people in the fold. And if you don't, you're going to get what you're going to get.
Yeah, no, he definitely got what he's going to get. And was surprised, I guess, by that loss that he had, because I think that he thought he was going to win and things of that nature. So I'm sure he was surprised by that. And one thing I can say about you is that you've definitely been at the forefront of issues and aren't afraid to show your face, even if it might be something that you are have alliances or you have connections to both sides of the issue, like even with the prison system and things of that nature. You have friends that are police officers, you have friends that are in the Black Lives Matter movement, but you come to those issues and you reach out to both of those folks.
And you have to, because there's 9 times out of 10, there's a place where we can all agree, right?
Right.
Because, you know, I got folks that say defund the police. I have some folks that are, you know, a step further that say, well, maybe we need more social workers to be with police, right? Some say we don't play police enough. Some say we ask them to do too much. Does that make sense? And all of that is true.
Right.
And so I think that you sometimes have to be in a place where you can hear what everybody is saying and then bring the best solutions to the table. That's what I think good representation is, right? Because as I get, you know, funneled into, you know, different conversations, the best case is that we know, and even when people say defund, there's a very few people that actually mean abolish. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Very few.
And the thing that I've said to folks about that is that should give you the most alarm bells when someone feels that, you know what, I'm better off without them than I am with them because of the history of, you know, misconduct or brutality. We need to pay attention to that. And that should let us know, you know what, we really do need to strengthen and rethink this system. I don't say we have to get rid of it, but it should give you alarm bells that parts of the population feel that strongly about it. And it's not like in a libertarian sense, right?
Yeah.
And that's what I want people to know, that it's not some ideological thing. It's the way they feel based on their life experience. But yeah, that's just how I roll. When I was in high school and in college, and that's just my life, you know, you have friends that could never be friends. And I think that just allows you to have the most broad perspective and to be that, again, that glue and that person who can take the ideas and now being able to put it into direct policy. Because there's no way, Mark, that we come out of this the same. We can't.
Yep, I agree with you on that. And it was interesting. I was talking to a gentleman yesterday on our regular online dinner party. He's actually running for governor for Florida in 2022. He's definitely a long shot candidate. He's an independent candidate. But that's one of the things he's talking about, was that he went through some of the parts of Florida. His name is Kyle Gibson. And he was talking to folks that were definitely very reactionary. They were kind of out of that whole Confederate kind of camp and things of that nature. But he went with them in the sense of he was going to talk to them and get an understanding of why that flag meant so much to them, why those monuments meant so much to them, and not try to make a judgment about it.
Yeah, and the thing about it is that, you know, when you start thinking about why it does, think about this. If somebody told you the history of your family, and the only thing they kept telling you was your great-granddaddy Jack was a hero. You know, he fought for our values. And that gets passed down, and that gets passed down, and that gets passed down. That's the only thing you know. You don't know it started with a lie. Nobody told you that part. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Nobody told you that even if your family thought they were fighting for the right thing, the people, the top 1%, the slave owners, knew it was about slavery. Whether they told you states' rights and northern aggression, but they knew and they lied to everybody saying, does that make sense? When they knew they just wanted to expand slavery and keep slavery where it was. And so I'm a huge James Baldwin fan. He just had a birthday, by the way. And he speaks so eloquently about how this, the lie of slavery and, like, you know, that, you know, post slavery going into Reconstruction, and how that lie about that original sin has just deteriorated our country. And we're getting closer every day to mending that. We got a long way to go, But the lie has just hurt folks that, especially, you know, those who believe in the Confederacy and those, and it's really hurt whiteness overall, because you got to ask yourself, even apart from that, you got to ask yourself, why did they need slaves? Why couldn't they do their own work? Right. Secondly, why do you need the Negro? Why do you need someone to look down on? Right. Why was there racial codes? If a man is equal and a man should be able to make his own way, that means you should look back and say, well, why did they have black codes? Why did they beat John Lewis on the bridge? Why did they not have them? You know what I'm saying? You have to look at those events and see how it has propped up whiteness. And no, you didn't do it. You didn't. But at the same time, it's okay for me to look back and say, you know what? I did love the history of my family and all that, but it's a part of my history, but they were wrong.
Right.
And the thing is that the pain of the being able to confront that is, it's easier to hang on to hate than it is to wrangle with the truth.
Right. You've got a good point there. And the other thing, I had a pleasure on my podcast, the audio podcast, Straight Talk with Dean and Mark, of talking to Roberta Oster. She does some work out of activism in Virginia, out of Richmond. And she also was a ABC anchor in the networks. I think she'd done ABC, NBC, stuff like that. And we were talking about the progressive movement in the country and things of that nature. And one of the things we talked about is the fact that the other side of the aisle does a really good job of using social media and putting their thoughts out there. We may not agree with their thoughts. We oftentimes think that the thoughts are crazy and things of that nature, but they put them out there. I don't know that we do a good enough job of that. So one of the things I know you've done is you've definitely had these conversations on a regular basis. I saw that you did one with one of your fellow people in the house and everything. You've done it with a lot of different kind of folks. So that's one of the ways that you counter. So I must give you kudos for doing that and say that you've done a good job of that. But as an overall whole, I think the progressive movement has not done a good enough job of that. Why do you think that is, and what can we do to address that?
Yeah, that true words have never been spoken. And the conservative movement has done a couple things right. They hear a message and they repeat it ad nauseum, right? They adapt the message and they get behind it. It ain't a whole lot of nuance, right? I mean, and on the progressive side, oh, it's nuanced. We got to fight about, you know, what shade of color, what shade of purple, you know? And they're like, oh, it's purple? Great, done. And I think that sort of lockstep mentality with the simple, and the other thing is they made the messages simple. They're multi-layered now, don't get me wrong, but they're simple in the outset. And that makes a difference. And I think that they understand the implications, not only the emotional, which Donald Trump exploited, but they also understand the things that some of their voters want. And I think we have done that, you know, better and better. But absent a charismatic speaker, they are able to weather through the storm. And they've done that since Nixon. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Nixon had the Southern strategy. Nixon had, ran into Reagan, you know, with the welfare queen, the tough on crime, you know, all these things have led them to a point where their folks internalize it. And I think for us to counter it, to be completely honest, is that we're going to first have to get out of our own way. Secondly, you know, we're going to have to reconnect, with, I think, people that we've lost. And the way you do that, you talk about bread and butter issues. And when you start talking about folks that are the most loyal, you show your loyalty to those who are the most loyal by making sure that they hear the policy in a way that's going to impact their lives. So, for example, if I'm worried about, you know, my health care, if I'm worried about my the disparities that are impacting my community, then I need to see policies that specifically say this is going to help Black and brown communities. Does that make sense? And there's no harm in that. It's being clear. when you're talking to, you know, progressive voters, they may care about more social issues. Talk to them about that. When, you know, if you're talking to more, you know, people like, funny enough, people in different parts of the state and, you know, even in Appalachia, a lot of those people vote internally Democrat. Kentucky has a Democratic mayor. I mean, a Democratic governor. You know, West Virginia has a Democratic senator. But when you're talking, you talk bread and butter table issues. Does that make sense? Which is our, you know, when you start talking about $15 an hour, good education and Medicaid expansion, which Missouri just passed, along with a few other red states, that speaks to me. Because guess what? Those rural, poor rural communities understand what that means to their life. You see what I'm saying? And so if you follow my thread, that's what it boils down to. It's speaking specifically to the communities in the way that does. And don't worry about, you know, how it's going to tick one off. You talk to me, right? Yeah. It needs to be one-on-one. And I think the other thing that that we, you know, and it has to be tailored, which means we're going to have to get out of this nationalized way of thinking through our progressive movement. Ideas may come progressively, but the way that we communicate them to our people is going to have to be there. And I think we're going to have to do a much better job, which we always do, is on the direct contact. We're going to have to strengthen that because people need, and it needs to be year round. And that's something that I've seen change over time. And that's something that that's why you see the way that I act as an elected official, because I don't want anybody to ever say, nah, he only comes around election time. I'd never forget hearing that in 2004. And I said, if I ever got into a place, I would not be that kind of person. And so I think that that's really what they have to do is, you know, you break it down, you make it simple, and you tie the policy directly to their lives. Don't try to get into all this nuanced talk about, you know, the world and, you know, and all that stuff. People that need it now. Does that make sense? They don't have time for that to talk them to death.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. What was it like in your mind following in that legacy of Representative Mashal and things of that nature? What does it mean to, I think you still have regular conversations when you can with Representative Mashal, but definitely, what does that mean to be following his legacy, and what kind of role does he play even in your career now that you're sitting in the seat that he held for so long?
Yeah, he's the ultimate roadmap. Because the thing that you have to do is when you think about, you know, what you're not hearing, right, what voices are not being at the table, what issues are not being raised, you know, his, you know, guidance is along the lines that he said it the other day when I said, well, what would you say to these new protesters? He said, the hottest places in hell are reserved for those who sit in a neutral place in the face of a moral crisis. And you see what I'm saying? And so he never wavers on, if there's something that you see that's wrong, you have to say something. And I think that, you know, that has sort of led me to, you know, I'm working across the aisle, right, of course. But when it comes to the things that I'm not going to budge on, people know. I'm not, you know, he and I have in common education, right? Education, HBCUs in North Carolina Central, and, you know, making sure that they're always at the table and being clear when they're not. You know, the other thing is voting rights. That's a legacy that from him specifically that I had in my gut. But, you know, when you walk into his, you get that honestly, you know, and, you know, you want to lead on it because, you know, every people having the access to the franchise is the equalizer. And so when you have somebody that directly fought for it alongside John Lewis and King, and believes that you can carry that thing forward. That's why that's probably where I've had the most success in the General Assembly so far is in voting rights and being involved and engaged in that conversation. So it not his direct and his indirect have led, but he's always open to my calls and having a conversation just because they're, you know, one thing I learned when I got there is Mickey, I mean, we know Mickey was a big deal, but when you go to the General Assembly, you realize, no, Mickey was a big deal. I'll never forget my first appropriations meeting, and which he was senior appropriations chair. And I looked around the room, and I had the budget in my hand. And I was like, Mickey, you were over all this? And he was like, yeah, that was all me, man, $24 billion budget. I was like, man. Wow. And, you know, when you think about that, it just – it humbles you because then it gives you – whoo, boy, I got a long way to go. But it lets you know that you have a resource that many people don't have. I gave him he came to my office when I first got elected, and I made sure I got an extra budget for him. Mm-hmm. He, over the phone, you know, talked me through different things, what to look for. But then when you put it in his hands, it was like an old ball player. It just fit. He knew exactly what to do, exactly where to go, exactly how to maneuver it, and could tell you what they did and didn't do just by picking it up. And so I'm inspired by a man. And, you know, I think that it's for me, I think some people are a little overwhelmed by, you know, something like that. And I think, you know, of course, we all are at times. But, you know, it's such a roadmap for someone who didn't have to live this life, who decided and stuck to live this life so they could help a lot of other people. And I don't, you know, my journey and his will be completely different. Right. And as he told me, and as others have as well, and as I, you know, that's the way I approach it. I'm going to have my own journey, and there are going to be a lot of overlaps with me and Mickey, right? But the thing that will remain true is that, you know, we're going to represent, you know, Durham. We're going to stick up for those things that that we absolutely believe in, and we're going to speak truth. You know, because, you know, again, like him, I could, you know, live a different life with, as it relates to, you know, being a little bit more middle of the road. But as he said, in the face of crises, somebody's gotta say something, you know, somebody's gotta call out and have this conversation with corporations about how are you spending money with Black folks? How are you hiring? What is your pipeline? You know, what you talk about state government, like, you know, what can we do to make sure that we get more Black general and Black and brown general contractors? How are Black and brown businesses getting access to capital? Does that make sense? Yeah. Like, well, why don't we have more Black and brown teachers in our classroom? Like, it's like you start to when you start to think about it, and when you have that frame of reference similar to his, not only is it who I am, but when you have somebody that has given you that sort of charge of when you see crises, and then it's funny enough, it's like getting, you know how you get your car and you start seeing other cars like yours on the road? Yeah. Like, you start to realize, damn, it is a lot of crises out here. And I can't boil the ocean, but I can sure enough speak up about these ones that I know something about. And so he's had an enormous impact, and I'm just glad that he's always, you know, there to talk, and, you know, will always give advice, sometimes without wanting or not. But hey, I'll take it as long as he's speaking.
And who were some of your other idols in terms of your political career and your political trajectory? So who were some of your other idols other than Representative Michelle, who you're definitely
I'm glad you said that, because one of the things is that he, you know, we've known each other for about 10 or 12 years. But, you know, when I got started, I mean, it's a host of people. You know, my first, you know, start with my grandmother. My grandmother, she served on the school board for a short time. She taught for 30 years and served on the school board for a short amount of time. And, you know, she was always, and I didn't know what that meant when I was, you know, in high school. But what I always knew is that she was always out. She was always helping people, right? She was always in the mix trying to, you know, make things happen. And then, you know, of course, you know, inspired, you know, my mother and dad, they were separate, but still had equal, you know, good impact. I had, you know, my first interaction with a, you know, Black male professional. I was probably about ninth grade. He made a huge difference in, you know, in my life, and made sure that, you know, all right, this is where I want to go. I'll figure the rest out later. I had, you know, especially in politics, folks all around, Brad Thompson, people that used to work for Hunt, you know, old school elected officials, Ralph Camp, you know, those kinds of, you know, people that when I was doing the stuff statewide, it was me and another guy moving around, and they, you know, were kind enough to speak to me. Judge Wynn, who's on, you know, the Fourth Circuit. Right. You know, little old ladies from different parts of the state who just, you know, invite me out to speak. And these were Black, White, Purple, and Brown. But one person that was huge in my transition from here to there, even more so than Representative Michelle, was Representative Hall, Secretary Hall. Yeah. You know, I ran his first campaign for State House in 2006, and we stayed close ever since then. And I mean, he, you know, I helped him, he helped me. We, you know, let me know how the General Assembly was. You know, he made that initial real connection with Mickey, and you know, making that, you know, that possibility for us to, you know, really think about, you know, what my transition plan was. And of course, it's all Mickey's decision, right? I didn't even know when he was going to announce that he was retiring. But Mickey, you know, Larry was really there to make sure that we, that he guided me so that I could be ready when it was time. And I'm just so thankful for him. But there's a host of others. I mean, Dr. Allison, even though we spar and it's sparred over the years, I mean, boy, I don't go anywhere without asking for disaggregated data because of her. And I understand, you know, all the stuff that she, you know, was trying to get across all those years. So it's a host of people that have all made a difference. I think, you know, the biggest one for the last, you know, again, 10 years or so, almost 8 to 10 was Mickey. But there were so many that poured into me and made sure that I got to the right place to keep my nose clean and I'm able to do this work.
What are some of the things that surprised you about the whole concept of one campaigning and what you've learned while being in the legislature? And then we had a listener that just popped on Facebook and had a question for you. And that was, they were asking, they're given their business title, which is North Carolina Black History and Business, but they were asking what can be done to stop the gentrification of Durham. So that was one of the questions our listeners was asking. So definitely I wanted to hear your answer.
Yeah, you know, that's a good one. And I think the best answer to that is the fact that we need to make sure that we realize that the city needs to say there will be no bad neighborhoods, right? They need to establish that and say that. And what that means is that the people who live, and you can't control housing markets, but what you can control is making sure that people have resources within walking distance that are fair and equitable. And the, you know, their street lights, that there are paved roads, that there are things that and programs that help people stay in their homes, and that there's a push. Somebody was talking about Maynard Jackson today and what you can do from that bully pulpit of city government. And what you can do and push is to say, you know what, we want to invest in this area, but no, we do not. We want to include them in the growth versus them having to be byproduct. Does that make sense? Yeah. And so I think if you go about it that way, so you're helping people stay in their homes, you're doing beautification projects, you're investing and bringing attention, and then you slowly but surely start to include resources and banks. And does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And all that encouragement lets people know, you know what, we don't have to wait for gentrification to happen first and then the resources follow, because that's what happens. And so I think that the city is going to have to make a huge role. Now, the state, I think in 2021, is going to have to take a hard look and the feds with housing, because housing is sort of the bedrock of it all. But I think that when you're, you know, thinking about that, there have to be hardcore local decisions that they're not going to allow communities to deteriorate. Because when you allow that deterioration, you have to stop it early. Because it inevitably, especially if it's within a mile of the downtown corridor, is going to be gentrified. So you have to make sure that they're not letting it fall down in the first place. And that has to be a real, you know, local decision and determination, and not just lip service.
And one of the other questions that was asked as well, and I'll flash that on the screen, is I think they were asking, when will Durham enforce that all cops and city officials should be from Durham and stop hiring outsiders? They're arguing that I guess we need more cops, teachers, and firemen actually from Durham, and especially those that are from here. So is there a way that that can even be enforced or things of that nature?
Yeah, they can try to incentivize them through different programs to live in Durham, similar to what they do sometimes with teachers and local employees. So I think that that's stuff that definitely can be on the table to help with making sure that they are, and generally that's a local issue, But like state, you know, that could be an issue that we do take to the state to see if people are open to allowing there to be a fund for, you know, people to, you know, tap into. Because that's part of it, right? Because people are going to, some people don't like living where they were. And then some people move for a lot of other reasons. But the thing that has worked that we know for sure is that when people know their communities, they serve them differently, and they're and the people know them and trust them, right? And so that's a really good question that we should ask the chief. And I know that she has heard that quite a few times, and it may be worth exploring long term to first start with the recruitment process, right? How many first are they doing their job to the point where people aspire, right? To, which a lot of our dorm officers are, but are they doing it and building that trust with the people like, I see you and I want to be you, right? That's the first thing. And that comes with the outreach in schools and neighborhoods. The second thing is what's their pipeline for recruitment. And so if we get a gang of people that want to live in Durham, who are from Durham, and then can be recruited to be cops, then that does start your process. But it, more than anything, is definitely a pipeline issue. But secondarily, it's an economic one. So I'm a...
And just so I know we got to wind down and everything, but I was wondering about reparations and things of that nature. Like I said, I did talk to Sandy earlier, and yeah, we were talking about that. And I know there have been some cities and some areas in North Carolina that have actually done things around that. From your perspective, do you think that's something that could even be done on a state or federal level and things of that nature? Because I know Asheville just recently passed it. I think there have been some talks about it here in Durham, but I was just wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, it's you know, it's one of those things, like, again, when we talk about failures of our federal government, that's one of the largest, right? Is that they can establish nationwide what a repayment looks like to those who have been impacted by you know, racial discrimination, slavery, you name it, right? And suppression, redlining, all of it. And so that's first where it starts. But I think, you know, and I'm, again, I'm 41, and I've heard this conversation most of my adult life. And it's gotten to the point where you actually now have bills filed. So the biggest thing that we can do is not give up on the conversation.
That makes a lot of sense. What are some of the things that you're most concerned about now as a representative, as you're going forward in your own tenure? So what are some of the issues that you are feeling you're very passionate about? You've mentioned education, but I'd like to know some of the other things that you're very passionate about right now and that you're really going to be pushing forward.
Well, it's education, it's police reform, it's making sure that we have a living wage, it's making sure that we pass, you know, Medicaid and have affordable healthcare options. Is making sure that when we start talking about, you know, equality and equity across, you know, our state, that we're absolutely, you know, putting ourselves in the best possible position to do that. And that we are, you know, doing things like broadband.
I want to say maybe like 400 or something.
Wow. Yeah.
Another call going on there. That's cool. But you say broadband and things of that nature. So we've got the broadband issue that a lot of folks are definitely have finding even now with all this virtual learning. I know a lot of people are thinking about broadband and the accessibility of the internet. So could you speak to that and what your thoughts are of that from the representative?
I have a technology issue about 10 minutes in.
Yeah.
There was a lightning strike.
Sorry, hold on. I apologize. My work call. I'm leading it. So, but yeah, I think that, you know, it's broadband has shown all the things that we hold dear have been exposed, and we need to do the work. So I've enjoyed the conversation. I'm gonna hop off to work, but
I understand. I'm just so glad that I was able to get this conversation with you. It was a very powerful conversation. I think a lot of folks learned about you and some of the issues that you are concerned about. So I definitely greatly appreciate you being on, and we'll have to get you back on again in the another session. Look forward to having you back on again in the very near future. So we're going to let Zach get back to his work and everything in his conference call with his coworkers and things of that nature. But Zach, I do want to thank you for being on the show and to giving us some insight into your career path and to your inspiration, the people that you are very supportive of, as well as some of your own thoughts and things of that nature. So once again, Representative Hawkins, I do want to thank you for being on the show, and do know that we will be reaching back out to you in the very near future to be back on again. But thanks again for being on the show with us and for sharing your insights and your knowledge about what's going on.
I've not yet heard that, so I appreciate it.
Once again, that was Representative Hawkins on, and I definitely want to thank him for joining us in the conversation, and it was a great conversation. I think that you learned a lot about his views on a variety of issues and some issues that our folks are very much concerned about in this day and time. So we learned about how he feels that progressive leadership is doing in the country and around the state here of North Carolina. He definitely is a proud supporter of Durham, North Carolina, and definitely enjoys being here in our area. So I definitely want to thank him for joining us here and for this great conversation that we had. Don't forget that if you're interested in being a guest here on the show, it is the online dinner party with Mark Lee. That's the one that we usually do on Wednesday. This was a special edition that we did with Representative Zach Hawkins. So definitely look forward to having more conversations with Representative Zach Hawkins and him sharing even more about what he is about and some of the things that he is involved in. So do keep that in mind, that that is something that we're going to have, is more of these kinds of great conversations. So we did talk to him about some of the things that he had going on and some of his concerns and everything from prison reform to housing to things of that nature. So he was a great guest, and I definitely look forward to his being on the show. We've been trying to arrange it for a while, and then we finally got him on. So it was great having this conversation with him and him even talking about following in the footsteps of some other great legacy people, whether that's Mickey Michaud, who I also know, or that I was following in the footsteps of John Lewis, who appeared once at the H.I. Heritage Center not that long ago. And I was actually had the privilege of being there when he made that appearance. So definitely want to thank Representative Hawkins for joining us on this particular special edition of the online dinner party. Don't forget that we have all kinds of great programming on a regular basis. So on Friday, we'll have Financial Friday. That'll be coming your way on this Friday on IBM.TV. And on Saturday, we have two great shows. We have Plant a Seed with Tish, and she definitely does some great conversations about ways that we can develop and treat ourselves. And, you know, it's a very holistic kind of approach to her living and things. So she's had a person that talked about the warrior spirit. She's had like some folks that come out of like that mindfulness kind of background and things of that nature. So it was a very rich discussion that we've had in the past on her show. And I'm expecting another rich discussion on this coming Saturday on her show on at 1 o'clock. And then on 12 o'clock on Saturday, we've got Funk from the Front Seat, and he's got a very special guest. That's right, Patty Collins, Bootsy Collins' wife, who is involved with him on a number of things, will be at that show. So definitely do not miss that particular episode. That is Patty Collins will be making a appearance, and I'm looking forward to that. I know that a lot of the production team will be there, and we'll be definitely watching Zach as he does his thing, and it should be an amazing show. So we're looking forward to that. And then, of course, we've got the other show that he does on Sunday at noon. So that is Funk with Zach. So we're looking forward to his being a having some other amazing guests on that show, because he's had some great conversations about the music industry, about funk music in particular, and about a number of other things. So definitely we are looking forward to that particular conversation, and we want you to join us at IBM.TV when that happens. It should be some great conversation and a great discussion. So definitely do keep that in mind, that there are some amazing guests that happen here on a regular basis. So I do want to thank folks like Oman Checkmate Hudson for joining us, or Orin Checkmate Hudson, and Veronica James, because I do see that they popped in and were giving their thumbs up to this great program and the conversation that we were having. And I also want to thank the folks from Facebook at North Carolina Black History and Business for asking their questions and showing their questions during the course of this show. So That being said, I'm going to wrap up this show. Usually it run with the full version of the online dinner party. It can run anywhere from 2 to 3 hours. But these special editions, they're quicker and they're a lot less time. So I know the one we did earlier today was about an hour and 5 minutes or so. And this one will end at just under an hour. So I do want to thank folks that have been watching for tuning in and for joining in our conversation. Once again, I do want to remind people that if they've got guests that they would like to be on, or if they'd like to be a guest themselves, they can reach me at bluesradio@gmail.com. That's bluesradio@gmail.com. And of course, they can go back on Facebook Live. They can go back, I believe, on Twitter, and they can definitely go back on YouTube and catch replays of these particular programs. So definitely do keep that in mind. If you would like to be a guest, or if you're interested in being a guest, or you have things that you would like to share, whether that's being an entrepreneur, whether that's being an activist, whether that's being somebody in those realms, or whether that's just being folks that have got different passions that you would like to share, then yes, we are open to having those conversations. So that being said, I'm going to pop on out of here. Now, talking, let y'all see the little bit of the logo, which is a group of folks having basically a dinner party. And then I will hit the end broadcast, and that is how we will wrap up this particular show. So once again, I want to thank folks for joining us in this particular edition, a special edition of the online dinner party with Mark Lee. And we had a conversation with Representative Zach Hawkins. So like I said, I've had the pleasure of meeting him and getting to know him. So this being said, I'm getting ready to pop off and show you that picture and then hit the end broadcast.